Well, Ken, thank you very much for the kind introduction. Also, I'd like to thank the Fields Institute for the opportunity to give this lecture. Maybe just before I start, I'll pick up where Ken left off. For those of us in probability, we're always sort of sitting halfway between the world of statistics and the world of mathematics. But I hope at least part of the sense of my talk is that these things are really not separate subjects, but totally integrated in some sense. And hopefully what I'm going to give is a little bit, actually, I guess one advantage of being retired is it's respectable to give kind of a historical talk. So this is not going to be my latest results, but kind of a survey, or we'll see in a minute what it's going to be. So the major theme of the talk is that there are certain basic statistical structures and probabilistic laws that remarkably appear in empirical data and theoretical models across the physical sciences and the life sciences. I participated in a workshop, this workshop called Current and Emerging Research Opportunities in Probability. It was held about a year ago, funded by the NSF. And the idea of this workshop was to look at the current state of the subject and see where things currently stand and where things are going and where the exciting developments are occurring. Of course, in these days, one tends to normally couch things eventually when publicly displaying them in terms of what are the applications. And in this report that you can find, I can give the website if anybody's interested, these areas were identified. Algorithms, for example, a whole area of applying probabilistic search methods in combinatorial optimization, Markov chain Monte Carlo methods with an immense number of applications these days. Statistical physics, I will say a fair amount about in my talk. But all of these areas, coming from the physical sciences, which today primarily I'll talk about things that are more closely related to the physical sciences, and tomorrow's talk will be things more recent that are somehow more closely related to the life sciences. So what I'd like to do in the talk is sort of not to talk about these applications, but to look a little bit about how the subject developed over the last 100 or so years, with emphasis, of course, on more recent things, how the basic ideas and some basic themes that turn out to be so powerful in so many different areas. So I've actually structured things in what I call six circles of ideas, which sort of represent different stages of the development of the subject. At the beginning, I'll talk about the emergence of the idea of probability law and what's a more modern manifestation of that, so-called universality classes. Then an area of intense development that occurred during my most active years, Markov dynamics and things related to this. And then after that, into the probabilistic modeling of more complex systems of interacting nature that appear not only in the physical sciences but also in the life sciences. And eventually, I hopefully will have time to end up with some more recent ideas where connections with ideas from genetics, population biology will appear. Okay, well, I thought to start with just an example of something which is rather intriguing, probably not as well known as some other things that you do in probability, the empirical discovery of a probability law. And this is maybe a very simple case, but something rather intriguing and a little bit thought-provoking if you've seen it for the first time. It's called Benford's Law. And way back in 1881, when people still used log tables, Simon Newcomb noticed, it was an observation, that the early pages of the log tables were dirtier than the later pages. And that started him to think, and he actually proposed something, which then was picked up by Benford in 1938, And he analyzed something like an amazing number of data sets, something like 20,000 data sets. These involved all kinds of things, Reader's Digest, things from Reader's Digest, molecular weights of chemical compounds, population sizes, sizes of rivers, and so on. And lo and behold, empirically, what you get is that the probability of the first, relative frequency of the first digit being 1 through 9 has the shape. Of course, a priori, you might guess it should be uniform. After all, why shouldn't it be just 1 and 9? And actually, if you look at the higher, if you look at the same tables, but you look at higher order digits, it becomes more and more close to the uniform. So it's rather intriguing. It's a nice, I won't really explain it, but first of all, the law itself called Benford's distribution of the first digit is just given by this log function. So P is the probability that the first significant digit is D. Okay, well, it's actually quite a long history, and at least to my mind, the nice, what I consider a nice, elegant explanation of it, and rigorous derivation of something which is formulated mathematically, was done only in 1996 by T.P. Hill, and he introduced a very precise mathematical idea of scale invariant distribution and base invariant distribution that explains from which you can derive Benford's law, and he gave some rationale why these data sets will in fact behave in this way so that you would expect this distribution. But anyway, this is a remarkable example of simply, and this happens, I mean, these data sets came from all different fields. Okay, well, of course, what's much more important and much more classical, I guess this is one of the most single most important formulas in the mathematical sciences, maybe in all science, the normal or Gaussian probability law. Of course, we've all studied that. And it, of course, it has a very long history. It goes back, I guess, early, at least as early as de Moivre in 1733. He derived it in the context of games of chance where binomial distribution arises, and this was derived as a mathematical approximation to the binomial distribution. And I think it was really probably the work of Gauss in his role with the astronomical observations that Gauss first formulated, there was some controversy why different observatories came up with slightly different values of various quantities, and he explained, well, there's a natural distribution of errors, which he called the law of errors, in this empirical data. And then in the 1800s, there was kind of slowly coming into the human sciences, into the biological sciences with Quetelet and particularly Francis Galton in his study of heredity, the role of the normal or Gaussian law became important from the point of view of describing empirical data. Okay, well, I thought this may or may not be well known, but I like it, because sometimes these things come up in surprising places. And this is just a very, very simple example of the central limit theorem, but has a nice little history. This was done, this example is due to Katz and Steinhaus, and it, I would highly recommend, there's a beautiful book by Mark Katz I'll refer to on the next page, sort of an autobiography of his, an intellectual autobiography where he was struggling with basic concepts. And one of the basic concepts he and Steinhaus were trying to understand was the concept of statistical independence. Of course, the mathematical definition of independence, we all know, it's quite simple, but it also has a conceptual meaning to describe something about events in the real world, and that's what he was struggling with. So Mark Katz, I don't know if anybody here is young enough to have had the opportunity to listen to Mark Katz. I did many times. He was one of the all-time great mathematical expositors. And in addition, he played a very essential role in the introduction of rigorous mathematical and probabilistic methods into statistical physics and into physics more generally. And I'll mention more about those developments later on. But it simply says, we take a series, we take n cosines, we add them up, we divide by root n, And the only requirement we place on it is that the lambda are linearly independent over the rationals. And then what we look at here, this is going to be, I just run these things and look at the relative amount of time that that function spends in the interval from A to B. Okay, so for every n, I can define this relative amount of time I spend in the interval of A to B. And lo and behold, I look at the limiting value of this when n goes to infinity, and I get the normal law. So it's a nice exercise for mathematics students to explain why is this the normal law. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I think I like very much this book by Mark Katz called Enigmas of Chance, because what sometimes when we teach mathematics, we forget some very basic concepts that now are very routine definitions. Even the masters had to struggle with these concepts when they're being formulated. And Katz and Steinhaus are pretty serious mathematicians, and they were struggling with this notion of independence. And at that stage, well, this nice little quote, even before the climax of our search for meaning of independence was reached, it became abundantly clear why tout le monde was justified in believing in the loi des erreurs. It proved to be both a fait d'observation and theorème de mathématique. So I think what Katz was trying to say is that there's a mathematical content to this, but also in probability much more than maybe in some other areas of mathematics, we are constantly interacting with trying to describe some part of reality. And that's essentially what is the content of that. Okay, well, I don't want to review elementary probability, but I just want to, one of the things I want to talk about is this idea of universality class, and this is sort of, if you like, the generic example. So why is that cosine series asymptotically Gaussian? And that's, if you go back, wrong direction. If you go back and look at these cosines, then you can very easily check that if you look at the probability law of the amount of time each individual cosine spends in different intervals, if the lambda i's are linearly independent over the rationals, they're independent. In other words, the probabilities are multiplicative in the limit. And that's the key. What we have here is then simply a sum of n independent random variables. And it's, or of course, with cosines, it's easy to see they're centered at zero. So these are zero. This is an example of zero mean independent random variables. And then, of course, in the early part of the century, and even before, some very basic tools were introduced. The idea, of course, independence is just the multiplicative law. And another important tool is Fourier transform or characteristic function, as probabilists like to call it, which allow us to calculate distributions of sums of random variables. It just becomes a routine exercise. So then the idea is, and this is sort of an idea that I will expand on in a number of different cases, the idea of looking at some objects in different scales. And the idea here is you're looking at this in a large scale, so you're looking at a sum of a large number of random variables and you're rescaling. So some kind of rescaling process. And then we can look at the characteristic function of the rescaled object. Of course, here we're running it through, we're allowing this to vary through nt, where n, of course, this is just the integer part. So we're sort of looking at this in a scale of sums. And then we can show, well, the idea is here, in proof of the central limit theorem, you prove that these psi n's actually converge to a limiting psi. Well, that's just somehow relatively elementary analysis. But what are the properties of the limit? That's what I'd like to emphasize. So the first property of the limit is this property psi t plus s is psi t times psi s, which can be reinterpreted this way, which if you think about it, this simply says that the increments from 0 to t and from t to t plus s are independent. In terms of probability laws, it's a convolution, and this gives so-called convolution semigroup. So convolution semigroup is a very beautiful object, and once we have a convolution semigroup, it implies that the law is infinitely divisible. In other words, infinite divisibility just means given any integer, I can find the sum of that number of random variables whose distribution is given by that random variable. So the infinite divisibility comes out of simply the limiting property of the object psi p plus s. And of course, this led to an entire development, which I won't go into, the so-called Kinchin-Levy representation of the most generally infinitely divisible random variable. And there's an extremely beautiful discussion of that and all the correspondence went back and forth between Kinchin and Levy in the autobiography of Paul Levy. Okay, so from our point of view, the other conclusion that comes out of this when we have a limit like that is that the limit satisfies a fixed point property. So here it satisfies this fixed point equation, where in this particular case, the function f is just this function I've written down, psi 1 squared, alpha, theta. Where theta alpha is something that depends, of course, on the particular problem that we're looking at. So what we've got out of this thing is that we have a limiting law, a limiting probabilistic structure, which can be identified with a fixed point of some mapping. Okay, so that brings, it's actually quite a nice picture to keep in mind. And it appears now in many areas of probability. We have a class of objects, and the limiting objects, the scaling limits of those objects, correspond to fixed points of some mapping. And then, of course, as mathematicians, it's very natural for us to kind of ask, well, first of all, are the fixed points stable or unstable? And what are the domains of attraction of those fixed points? And these days we call these, inspired by, I guess, the physicists were the first to use this idea of universality class. But, okay, in the case of the sums of independent random variables that I just taught you, it turns out, roughly speaking, there are a number of fixed points. Well, in fact, more or less these are the fixed points that are written down here, the Gaussian law, and some other laws which we call stable distributions, stable laws. Well, we've already seen, so the Gaussian law corresponds to so-called short tails, which just for the moment we can think of as the second moments or something a shade higher than second moments are finite, then we're in the so-called domain of short tails, and we have the normal limit. But actually, so-called long tails, and this is something which, mathematically has been there for a long time, but very recently has become very important in applications or statisticians and applied scientists are using, this in fact they call it the NOAA effect. So the idea that you have something with very large random fluctuations, NOAA effect. And this, for example, is now became very interesting in the idea of, say, studying internet traffic, because when we went from voice calls to, computers logging on, then the distribution of the length of calls sort of went from short tail to long tail. And in fact, there's a very famous paper on the effect of this, which then corresponds to a long-term dependence in the time behavior of the internet traffic. And there's, we may have a chance to say something about that later on. So anyway, this whole idea that we have universality classes corresponding to fixed points and their domains of attraction is something which is, I think, one of the key themes of probability in the last 50 years, or maybe even 100 years. Okay, well, let's move ahead in the historical picture. Of course, once we had that independent increment property, we could actually look at what happens at a finite number of times, not just at one or two times. And we can write down in the case of, that limiting structure where the increments are independent, and Gaussian, we can write down, what is the behavior of the limiting object at a finite number of times. Of course, these are just increments. These things just correspond to these Gaussian laws in which the parameter, the variance parameter, corresponds to the length of the time interval. So it describes the thing a finite number of times. And more or less, historically, as probably everybody knows, Bachelier and Einstein both independently came across this object, which we now call, of course, Brownian motion. Of course, they thought about it. Basically, their level of description was at the finite, so-called finite number of times, finite dimensional distributions. And it still amazes me is that this paper in 1923 by Norbert Wiener, because he introduced the so-called Wiener measure, which is the law of Brownian motion, this limiting object. But this was, you know, several years before Kolmogorov's axiomatization of probability. And, I tried to read his paper many times. I even asked him once personally a question about it. I never understood. But somehow the message got out from Kolmogorov. Basically, what he showed was these things will then give you a measure that you can then calculate the outer measure of the space of continuous functions as outer measure one, and the rest is history. And so, of course, then we think now, of course, we always think in terms of trajectories, the path picture of Brownian motion. And, of course, these paths have some interesting properties, which I'll mention in a minute. So kind of in the evolution of things, there was this, first of all, these ideas of laws, limiting laws of sums of random variables and these basic objects that you get in terms of fixed points. And then there was a conceptual, of course, one conceptual breakthrough was Wiener's, where you think of this now as a measure on space of continuous functions. And for those of us who are around, I was a little bit young at that time, but when I was around at about that time when these things were being studied, there was another conceptual step in understanding that the idea is one could think about convergence not only at these finite number of times, but convergence of laws on trajectories. And this is so-called Donsker's invariance principle, which says that these things not only converge in the sense that we talked about before, but one can introduce a metric on C and a notion of convergence of probability measures on a metric space. And, of course, this turns out to have many, many important applications in deriving distributions of various statistics that occur all throughout mathematical statistics. Brownian motion has, well, I'll say and devote a couple of slides to it. Brownian motion has many amazing properties. Well, first is this self-similarity, which recently has become, of course, a topic which even hits popular magazines, which things that in different time scales look the same way. So it doesn't matter what time scale you look at Brownian motion in, it basically has the same structure. And that is something which is now also characterizing what's called fractional Brownian motions that suddenly came up in mathematical finance and in studying internet traffic. Another property that's important is, well, if you're a student, when you first study analysis, you're asked to find an example of a function which is nowhere differentiable. It's a hard job. Turns out to be this Brownian, this Wiener measure, gives Wiener measure one to the set of functions that are almost surely non-differentiable and positive quadratic variation. Well, I mean, I think it's arguably Brownian motion is to the probabilist like the prime numbers are to the number theorist. This is a very, very basic mathematical object. And, well, one of those people who has devoted his lifetime to it and is probably, well, arguably the number one expert in the world on Brownian motion is Mark Yore. And he wrote a beautiful book on Brownian motion, and these are just a couple of quotes. He said, and this is very recently, he was writing this book, and he was extremely astonished at the number of very natural questions that have escaped attention until very recently. So this is still a very active area of research. And one of the questions he raises is to understand better the ubiquity of Brownian motion in a great number of probabilistic problems. So this is sort of an object which has a very beautiful mathematical structure, but also appears throughout many, many areas of the sciences. Okay, well, now that's sort of, if you like, the classical period of probability theory. At least I guess you could argue that's the classical period of probability. And in the, well, late 30s, I guess, early 40s, and then of course there was the war, and immediately after the war there was an explosion of developments in so-called Markov processes, the Markov property. And that's then thinking of things dynamically. So it's sort of the dynamical viewpoint of probabilistic structures. And what's behind this is the notion of conditional independence. So as we mentioned earlier, it was eventually, through a lot of struggle, the central notion, the central importance of the idea of independence was played a very big role in the development of probability. But something which I think is equally important, or maybe even more important for today, is the notion of conditional independence. And of course, we had a very beautiful program at Fields Institute on conditional independent structures a few years ago. And that's something which is basic to the ideas of probabilistic reasoning. But in any case, from the point of view of these processes, which are just varying in time, the Markov property means that if I know the present, I can regard the future and past as independent. And that's very important because then I can do calculations. If I know the current state, I can just simply multiply probabilities or conditional probabilities. So it's a powerful tool. And then to implement this idea, then the development of the subject is starting from Brownian motion. Well, of course, we can now define a different, we already associated with Brownian motion a convolution semigroup, but this is a different semigroup. This is a semigroup acting on the space of functions, continuous functions on, in this case, the real line. And it's simply defined this way. It's going to be defined for any continuous function. We define TTF as this integral. And it has this, of course, semigroup property. And of course, this was developing at the same time, and more or less many, many of these developments, sort of, it was a mathematical development sort of in parallel to the probability development. This sort of went hand in hand with the development of what's called the Hill-Yoshida theorem, which is a theorem that characterizes in some very precise way semigroups, strongly continuous semigroups of operators on Monic space. So in particular, in this case, this sort of ties up with that whole theory in functional analysis. And also, it brings to bear probabilistic methods on partial differential equations, because the solution, if I simply look at TTF, if we're corresponding to the Brownian motion, this satisfies the heat equation, which of course is again one of the very basic mathematical objects of analysis and partial differential equations. So there's a relation here between partial differential equations, and of course this has been developed very extensively by Dube and by many mathematicians, the relation between the two subjects. Well, as a tool, of course, the Markov property by itself is a very beautiful property, but to give us a sort of world of very concrete examples, we needed, well, in fact, was very fortunate that Kiyoshi Ito discovered what's called the Ito calculus, which probably now it's like bringing coals to Newcastle to talk about Ito calculus here in Toronto because of the financial business. But in any case, Ito discovered that, of course, because Brownian motion is not differentiable, is not a bounded variation, we can't define the usual calculus using Riemann-Stieltjes integrals. So he introduced a calculus, which is the appropriate calculus for studying functions of Brownian motion. And of course, this famous Ito rule. And from that, then this opened up a whole world of studying whole range of kinds of interesting probabilistic models. So we then use the Brownian motion as a basic building block. Well, close to Newcastle here, I'll say it. So the geometric Brownian motion, of course, is the solution of this Itô stochastic differential equation. Of course, this is sort of the key, or one of the key objects, in the derivation of the famous Black-Scholes formula for option pricing. And of course, this is still a very exciting and interesting area of research, because of course here we kept sigma here is just a constant. But the whole idea when the financial understanding financial data is that this is what's called volatility. It's the analog of temperature. So when we talk about a physical system, we have a temperature, which is sort of the level of random agitation, or for example in genetics, mutation rate. It's the amount of randomness in the system. And here this sigma is the volatility. But it's much more interesting and complicated than that. There's a whole huge amount of very exciting research going on in modeling volatility and studying various aspects corresponding to volatility. Well, I mentioned a lot of what I'll talk about is sort of related to the physical sciences. And this next little piece of a slide is also has a very, very important history. Those people who study quantum physics remember that one of the key developments in the study in the theory of quantum mechanics was Feynman's introduction of the path integral approach. And this is related. This is not the path integral of quantum mechanics, because that's complex solid measure. But in conversations, I don't know the exact history, but Feynman and Katz, this is very closely related to the issues that come up in the path integral approach to quantum mechanics, namely to calculate some quantity as an integral with respect to a measure on a function space. This turns out to be a very powerful, it's a very powerful tool to this day in physics. And so this is this is the baby example of it, but a very, very important one, because what it really tells us, if I want to study this partial differential equation, which is a rather simple one, granted, but it has a lot of interesting applications, I can study it using the Brownian motion, which is the solution corresponding just to half Laplacian u, but writing down a path integral. So it simply says, if I want to calculate the semigroup corresponding to the solution of this equation, then I can calculate it in terms of a integral over function space using Brownian motion and this factor, this so-called change of probability measure, which is, again, one of the basic tools that's also used in financial mathematics in getting so-called equivalent martingale measure. So this is, again, a whole idea and set of tools that somehow probability and analysis came together, and many, many interesting and very difficult problems have been solved by sort of trading off, going back and forth between the probabilistic and the PDE versions of this picture. Well, it's also, I just wanted to mention this because this is something more recent, that if you look at this equation, well, this is a special case of the basic mutation selection equation from mathematical biology, where you have the function V is the fitness, so-called, in that case, would be the fitness function. And, of course, not only is it sort of coming from an equation, this is a special case of the general mutation selection equation, but in this particular form, it's also become the basis of a method called the nonlinear genetic algorithm. So, the of course, you can see what happens here is the solution of this thing is going to tend to put more weight on paths where this integral is smaller positive. And it's going to penalize those areas where this integral is, well, I mean, where minus integral is negative. So it's going to look, if you like, intuitively, it's sort of looking for the minima of the function v. And that idea is sort of behind the idea of sort of a probabilistic approach to looking for the global minimum of a function. And that's well, it's an area which I can't really get into. I'll mention on the next slide, sort of, if you like, this is a way of thinking about trying to solve optimization problems if you have no information about the structure of the problem using these ideas that sort of are tied in with genetics. And on the next slide, we're going to see the analog from world inspired by physics. So one of the basic models of the physical sciences is the idea of motion, gradient motion, and a potential. So we have a function v, then if you just simply look at, you know, dx dt equals minus gradient v of x of t, you can solve. But then if it's randomly perturbed with some noise, well, then we would expect that we would get an equation of this type. And this is so-called, well, it's a Nito stochastic differential equation. Here, think of sigma corresponding to a temperature parameter. So if sigma is small, it means low temperature. Sigma is big, it means high temperature. And then this process, we can also look what happens when T evolves over long periods of time, and it will converge to an equilibrium. And that equilibrium is a Gibbs distribution. In fact, it's just exactly the distribution I've written down here. This exponential minus 1 over sigma squared V of X is, and that's, if you like, the simplest possible example of what's an extremely important class of distributions that we'll continue with in a minute. But the idea of Gibbs distribution as being, so what's very special about this kind of physical, this kind of equation is that the dynamics in equilibrium is time reversible. So of course, you know, there's of course many philosophical discussions about reversibility in physics and so on. But for the class of models that come from statistical physics, in equilibrium, they're naturally time reversible. So it doesn't matter. The law, if you play the movie backwards in time, it has exactly the same probabilistic structure as if you played it forwards in time. And that's not true of systems that come from the life sciences, or not in general true. So I just wanted to point out there's one very important special case of this, which corresponds to the quadratic, when v is a quadratic function, and that corresponds then to the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck, so-called famous class of Ornstein-Uhlenbeck processes that appear throughout the physical sciences. And also, once again, of course, the gradient system tries to move towards the minima. So in fact, it moves to the closest local minima. And of course, once again, the idea of using the gradient system to find minima is quite important. But of course, the problem with gradient search is you can get trapped in a local minimum. And the idea is that if you add some noise, you can be kicked out from a local minimum, and eventually you should get to, anyway, it's the idea, you should get to the global minimum. And that corresponds, that was, well, the people here in the audience who are experts on this, this sort of led to the idea of a class of algorithms called simulating annealing algorithms, which are exactly to run these things where you vary the temperature and hopefully look for a global minimum. So it's a kind of stochastic optimization technique. Okay, well, so that was all in one dimension. And if we now move to Brownian motion in two dimensions, what that means is simply you look at the two coordinates are independent Brownian motions. And then, for example, if you plot the curve of Brownian motion in two dimensions, you get, well, this is just a typical picture. And the question is, what is the geometrical structure of this mathematical object? That's an extremely interesting problem that's really, well, I'll mention, I guess, tomorrow, very recent result where this has actually been one of the basic open problems about the structure of this geometry has been solved. It's a very difficult problem to really describe the geometrical structure of two-dimensional Brownian motion. So roughly speaking, in probabilistic models, when you go to two dimensions, and then, well, I call intermediate dimensions, high dimensions, something very for a whole class of physical and probabilistic phenomenon, the behavior is very, very highly dimension dependent. In low dimension, something happens. Intermediate dimension, something happens. High dimension, something different happens. Roughly speaking, as you go to high dimensions, things become simpler. Even though we have a very high, difficult conceptualizing high dimensional phenomenon, mathematically certain things become simpler. And the intermediate dimensions tend to be the hardest. Well, in terms of finite dimensions, well, this is going to be another finite, an example of a finite dimensional concrete system. It's quite interesting. So I introduced just a minute ago these Ornstein-Uhlenbeck processes. So these are stationary Gaussian processes. And now if we look at real symmetric n by n matrices, in which we take the upper triangular entries to be independent Ornstein-Uhlenbeck processes with, okay, this parameter gamma is sort of the amount of randomness in the system, if you recall. So we have an n by n matrix, and we look at its eigenvalues. And, well, this is a bit more problematical set of stochastic differential equations than most that we come across, because, of course, there's some possible divergences here. There's some, of course, this thing could be singular. What it really means is that the eigenvalues of these matrices have the property there's a very strong repulsion, so they'll never meet. And in fact, if you look at the stationary distribution, and once again, now you look at the size of the matrix letting it go to infinity, you get this very famous result of Eugene Wigner called the semicircle law. So if you look at the number of eigenvalues less than or equal to lambda, and now you normalize and you take the limit, you get a distribution on the interval from minus 1 to 1, which is got this well, so-called semicircle formula. Remarkable result. And just, you know, this is, again, now an example where this basic notion of universality class once again arises, because it turns out you might say, well, it's this very special class of processes, Gaussian and so on. But no, it turns out that if we study n by n real symmetric matrices with only some special, well, some relatively just structural properties, something about the second moments of the off-diagonal terms, and something about the second moments of the diagonal terms, and then something about the decay at infinity, for that entire class of symmetric matrices, the same limiting circle law will arise. So it's kind of a universality class. This is something which is still not fully understood. This is a very much of a recent area of research. Zero one matrices. Well, I guess if they satisfy those conditions, they would. Yeah. So it's well. Okay, we discuss later. But yeah. So a closely related class of n by n matrices is so-called Gaussian unitary ensemble, which we heard about last summer at the 10th anniversary of the Fields Institute. So, I mean, these originally things came from solid-state physics of looking at these. So exactly the same thing, but instead of real symmetric matrices, we look at unitary matrices, Hermitian matrices with real and complex off-diagonal elements, independent Gaussian. And I guess that's understandable what we mean by that. And then there's this amazing hypothesis that, of course, has created a lot of interest, originally due to, I guess, conversations between the physicist Freeman Dyson and the mathematician Hugh Montgomery, that the statistical properties of the eigenvalues of these matrices and the spacings of the Riemann zeta function have similar statistical structure. And of course, this is now called the Gnooi hypothesis and being explored from many different points of view. In the 10th anniversary of Fields Institute, we had this beautiful talk by Percy Diaconis, where he actually looked at this from a statistician's point of view, and he actually analyzed statistically the data coming from 175 million neighbors of the 10 to the 20 of 0, the Riemann zeta function. It's a bit mind-boggling that somebody could compute these things, but they exist on the web. And not only that, but from point of view of mathematical theory, there's indications, beautiful work of Rudnick and Sarnak, that these things are not just true of the Riemann zeta function, but some class of L functions. And there's a whole set of, well, I mean, what exactly is meant? One has a tool to calculate certain things, but not everything. And here, in fact, well, this comes from, I guess, Percy's paper, that if you look at the curves corresponding to the distribution from the Gaussian unitary ensemble and the spacings between the zeros of the Riemann zeta function, of course, properly normalized, it looks to the eyeball like they're one and the same distribution. Okay, so final circle of ideas for this talk is, of course, we went there and we had then finite dimensional systems. But this whole idea of looking at finite dimensional systems of different sizes has turned out to be one of the key areas for more modern developments. And the classical example of this, or the first really important example, is the Ising model. So the Ising model is a model to describe ferromagnetism. So we all know that iron can be magnetized, but if we heat up the magnet, then the magnetization disappears. And the mathematics, what model, how to describe that, was one of the basic problems of statistical physics. And so the methodology, the ideas that went into how to solve these things, was first of all how to formulate what is a mathematical model of ferromagnetism. So the model was, maybe just go to the next slide for the minute. Let's look at something very, very simple. To look at a grid, and on each grid site, you'll have either magnet pointing up or pointing down. And the idea is we're going to have some kind of mechanism that tends to make all these little magnets want to line up together. Oops, sorry, not too good. Okay, so it turns out the mathematical formulation for this is an extension, a generalization of that notion of Gibbs distribution that I mentioned a little bit earlier. So the Gibbs distribution says, okay, I'm going to look at all configurations. Here the Xi's are just plus or minus ones. And I look on the grid, plus or minus ones. And I'm going to define an energy function, which is of the form summation Jij Xi Xj, where I sum over nearest neighbors. And then the corresponding Gibbs, this is on a finite block. Corresponding Gibbs distribution is just the distribution given by this exponential formula, which looks exactly like the one I gave earlier with this V function V. And here beta is the inverse temperature. Okay, so what turns out to be the explanation or a mathematical formulation of magnetization is the idea of phase transition. And the idea is, of course, in this finite region, and I'll say a bit more about the relation between finite and infinite regions tomorrow, but in this finite region, of course, the thing will reach some kind of equilibrium, and somehow it doesn't give us the right framework in which to understand ferromagnetism. What's needed is, once again, mathematical idealization. I mean, we know many, many times in the history of science, formulating something with a mathematical idealization allows us to make something precise that otherwise is difficult. So to make this precise, what we have to do is we have to let k go to infinity. And then we get a random field on the infinite plane, well, on the infinite lattice. And then it turns out that if you look at probability measures, corresponding to all configurations on the infinite lattice, lo and behold, there's going to be the possibility there are going to be two invariant measures, one where most of the little magnets are pointing plus one, and another one where most of them are pointing minus one. And if you raise the temperature, If you increase the temperature sufficiently, then the magnetism disappears, that there's only one invariant measure where the average is going to be zero. So this is a very, very beautiful mathematical result, which gives incredible insight into physics. So this idea of phase transition and the whole methodology of studying phase transitions now, of course, it's sort of bread and butter of statistical physics. And let me just, I think I'll end in 1 minute, but let me just say a couple of words. Of course, there's a long history to this development, but how to formulate the mathematical structure corresponding to that Ising model. And that's the idea of Markov random field, which again comes back to conditional independence. So it's, if you like, I mean, many people try to do this, they, you know, from elementary course in probability, you have the definition of Markov chain, Markov process. And then if you look at the lattice, you can ask yourself, well, how do I generalize the Markov property to higher dimensions? And of course, there's no real answer. But what turns out to be one possible definition is what's called Markov random field. And that would say that the conditional distribution of this site here, given the four neighbors, is independent of everything else outside. So in other words, if you like, the boundary now serves to be corresponding to what was in the case of Markov process, just the present. So conditional independence of the interior and exterior of finite connected regions corresponds to the Markov random field property. Well, not only that, but then there's a relation between Markov random fields and their dynamics, which was developed. What mechanism for flipping the signs will correspond to the Ising model or correspond to this? And it turns out exactly what's needed is something which makes the whole dynamics, this time reversibility, hold. Unfortunately, time has just about run out, so I really can't say very much more about it. But starting in the 70s, Frank Spitzer in the United States and Dobrushin in the Soviet Union, at that time Soviet Union, developed schools of researchers who explored and developed this whole idea of Markov random field, this extension of the idea of Markov property and the dynamics that went with it. And it's had great advantage in clarifying many very basic ideas from physics and statistical physics. So I'm sorry, this was a little bit like the two-hour bus tour of New York City. But I just wanted to sort of give an idea, sort of a flavor of how the subject is developed. And tomorrow I will sort of carry on, but with more recent and things a little bit closer to the life sciences and more complex systems.